This is a BBC podcast. You can get all our podcasts and our terms of use at bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.
Now it's time for the final part of the series, The Greatest Hits of the World, presented by Paul Gambaccini.
The greatest hits of the world are hits all over the world. Sometimes they travel from country to country, changing form as they go. Whether you know the song as The Lion Sleeps Tonight, Whim Away, or Mboube, whether you know it from The Tokens, The Lion King, or Pete Seeger, it descends from a song that originated in Johannesburg. Some songs are about social justice. The story behind The Lion Sleeps Tonight is about the search for social justice for its composer. In the year 2000, the South African journalist and musician Rian Malana wrote an article called The Lion's Trail for Rolling Stone magazine.
This is a story that begins in 1939 when a Zulu migrant laborer named Solomon Linda walked into what was then the only recording studio in sub-Saharan Africa. It was located in downtown Johannesburg, belonged to the Gallo Record Company, and Solomon and his band, the Evening Birds, had come to do a recording. After lunch, they tackled a ditty that they called Mboube, which, like most African music, it sort of featured aspects of improvisation. And on the third take, Solomon Linda divested himself of what I call the miracle melody. It's a skein of 11 notes that went on to become the most famous melody ever to emerge from Africa. It went more or less like this. And if you go back to 1939, the sort of recording industry in South Africa was in its infancy, so the resulting acetate would have been shipped to London and then the finished records shipped back and put on the market. Now, at that time in South Africa, very few African people would have had the wherewithal to buy gramophone record players. But nevertheless, there's something about the song that really grabbed the African imagination. And over the next decade or so, it sold 100,000 copies, which is an extraordinary tally for a little third world country in South Africa. Made the song completely legendary, and I suppose made Solomon Linda legendary as well. So this enormous success of Mboube, I suppose it added hugely to the luster of Solomon Linda's name and made him a household word, certainly among Zulus. In fact, that song was so famous that it spawned an entire genre of music, Zulu choral music, known as Mboube music. Ladysmith Black Mambazo, the sort of famous South African Iskatimiyo group, the music that they performed is called, in South Africa, it'd be called Mboube music. That's precisely the sort of Zulu choral music that Solomon Linda pioneered in the 1930s. And of all the versions, I mean, I'd have to say, I'm afraid my favorite version of Mboube is the very first one, but Ladysmith Black Mambazo says they've got the spirit.
Mboube might have stayed Africa's greatest hit, unknown outside the continent, had Gallo Records not sent a pile of its discs to Decca in the United States in the hope that an American artist might sing one of the songs. The folklorist Alan Lomax, best known for his field work in recording folk songs in the USA, rescued the Gallo 78s from a pile of rejects.
Lomax said, well, don't throw those things away. I'll take them around to Pete Seeger because it's the sort of thing he's interested in. He had a reputation around New York as a folk singer and also as a guy who had a sort of open ears and an open heart and was very interested in what we would today call world music. And Pete Seeger listened to these records, and the one that really stood out for him was Mboube. So he sat down and transcribed it, and because he was an American and English-speaking, he had not the slightest idea what Solomon Linda was singing. The Zulus were going, Oyimbube, Oyimbube, Oyimbube. To him it sounded like, Oyimoe, Oyimoe, Oyimoe.
Pete Seeger was a member of the folk quartet The Weavers. With his colleagues Ronnie Gilbert, Lee Hayes, and Fred Hellerman, he had enjoyed 13 weeks at number one in America with a version of Leadbelly's Goodnight Irene. Commercial as well as artistic reasons demanded the Weavers look for more ethnic songs with the potential to become pop hits.
In 1951, they recorded this remarkable version of Mboube. It was sort of this huge, like, brassy Las Vegas confection with orchestrations and so forth done by Cat, who worked with Frank Sinatra, and Pete Seeger doing his best to sing a style that was, like, sort of insanely incomprehensible for him, which is this Zulu falsetto, the stuff that the miracle melody that Solomon Linda had come up with in 1939. A very difficult thing for a white man to sing, and I must give Pete Seeger his due. I think he did it rather well.
The Weavers' version of Whimaway was produced by Gordon Jenkins, who also conducted the orchestra on the group's hit recordings of Zena 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 from Israel and So Long It's Been Good to Know Ya by Woody Guthrie. Whimaway was so popular and so catchy that early 1950s versions followed by artists ranging from Tommy Dorsey to Ema Sumac. In the late 1950s, America was gripped by a revival of interest in folk music. The most commercially successful version of Whimaway appeared on the 1959 gold album The Kingston Trio Live from the Hungry Eye. But the most important performance appeared on The Weavers at Carnegie Hall, recorded in 1955 and released in 57. It was this album that caught the attention of New York City teenager Jay Siegel.
I was still in high school, and I was a big fan of folk music, and one day I was listening to the radio, and the radio station was playing an album called The Weavers at Carnegie Hall, a live album. Then I heard this song called Whimaway, and I thought, what a great piece of music. And I was just a kid. I was, 16, 17 years old. And I just was enthralled and taken by the falsetto sound of Pete Seeger. And I said, wait, I can do that, you know? And it just never got out of my head. And in Brooklyn, New York, where I grew up, we all had singing groups on every street corner, I guess, as well as all the five boroughs. That was a big thing in the middle 50s, you know, form singing groups. And I was able to sing this Whimaway and taught the background to the group that I was in at that time. And that's how I first came to hear the song, you know, was The Weavers at Carnegie Hall, a live album.
You're listening to The Lion Sleeps Tonight, part two of The Greatest Hits of the World from the BBC. Solomon Linda was paid a one-off fee of 10 shillings when he recorded Mbube in 1939. He never wrote the song down and never received royalties. Pete Seeger sent $1,000 of Whimaway earnings to Linda, thinking that everybody else would send royalties too.
Pete Seeger told me that he believed that thereafter that all royalties from that song had actually gone to Linda or to Linda's family. Unfortunately, this wasn't the case. They did receive a trickle of royalties from the Whimaway version. If you'd bought the Weaver 78 of Whimaway on the record label between brackets, it would have said this is a song by Paul Campbell. Now, who's Paul Campbell? You know, on paper at least, he was one of the great songwriters of the period. He was credited with a song like Hush Little Baby or A Kiss Is Sweeter Than Wine. There were also hits for the Weavers. And Paul had a buddy called Jesse Cavanagh who wrote songs like Green Sleeves and Michael Row the Boat Ashore, etc. So, unfortunately, Paul Campbell and Jesse Cavanagh didn't exist at all. They were fictitious entities who served as aliases for certain New York publishers who, what these guys were doing, it wasn't illegal. It's like the sophisticated music of the time, classical music and sort of Broadway music, was protected by copyright. But then there was all this other music around in the world, the music of black people in the American Deep South, the music of rednecks and cowboys, the music definitely of people who lived in Africa. Came from places where nobody knew about copyright law, where none of the songs had been copyrighted. So those songs whose ownership and authorship was like somewhat in doubt. I'd describe them as sort of wild horses. You know, these guys in New York were saying, this beast is roaming around in the plains. It doesn't belong to anyone. We'll just corral it and we'll put our name on it. This is what they did to Whimaway. They took Solomon Linda's song, and because it had never been copyrighted, they put their brand on it, and it went out into the world as a song by Paul Campbell.
In 1961, the Tokens reworked Whimaway with producers Hugo Peretti and Luigi Criatore, two cousins best known for their work with Sam Cooke and the Isley Brothers.
When our producers told us that they thought this was a great piece of music, but it should have a lyric to it, we were totally against that. We wanted to be a folk rock act, and we wanted to be purists and sing it as I heard it from the Weavers and just add some different melodic lines to it. But they insisted that it should have a lyric. They wrote the lyric. I was handed the lyric on a yellow legal pad. I wish I still had that, by the way, in the studio at RCA Studios. And I had to make the melody fit the lyrics, so I changed the melody, and that's how that beginning line, you know, that was part of mine, part of, I don't know if I should call it Pete Seeger's or Solomon Linda, who was the original writer of the melody.
As Jay Siegel mentioned, Hugo and Luigi commissioned an English language lyric from George David Weiss, with whom they had co-written Elvis Presley's Can't Help Falling in Love. Weiss was a veteran lyricist who had already co-written Lullaby of Birdland and would later write What a Wonderful World. It was through the pen of George David Weiss that Whimaway became The Lion Sleeps Tonight.
The only discernible words in the original recording were Uyumbebe, Uyumbube, which means he's a lion. I was told when I interviewed the Tokens, when I was doing that story for Rolling Stone, they said that they called the South African embassy. And the South African embassy had told them that, yeah, this is a song about hunting lions, and the words went something along the lines of, yeah, we're going to hunt a lion, we're going to be eating lion meat tonight. That's, I'm afraid, complete nonsense. No, I think mostly George David Weiss was working off, his sort of Americanized fantasies of life in African jungles, surrounded by lions with spears and so forth. So I think this is Americans exercising their fantasy. But nevertheless, look, I mean, it was pop music, but I mean, the results of George David Weiss's interventions were, I think, quite ingenious, and the resulting song was number one in America and three giant strides.
The Lion Sleeps Tonight was an international smash for the Tokens, which allowed them to travel the world.
We were one of the first artists that RCA sent over to Europe because the record, when it came out, it initially sold about 3 million records in the United States. And then as we found out and got charts from all over the world, it became a number one record in 36 countries all over the world. And London, that was our first stop on our first European trip in 1962. We ended up doing a big TV show in Rome, Italy, and I remember the president of RCA, Victor, said that we're going to send you guys to Rome. So we thought they were going to send us to Rome, New York, you know, because there's a Rome in New York, never thinking that we were going on a big European tour. And it was a very surreal thing from four kids from Brooklyn, New York, to get off a plane in London, and everybody knows who we are, and our pictures are in the newspaper, and everybody knows this record. It was a very, very surreal experience.
You would have found also that there was a local version that was very popular in Britain by Carl Denver. Did you
Carl
hear that?
Carl Denver, yes. I know that he, I think he really got a very big hit record, Carl Denver. He was able to do that falsetto as well.
And then through the years, the record kept coming back. I always think it's about due for another revival because it always does come back, and it came
back.
Well,
I hope you're right.
Of course, Robert John had his top three version in the States.
Well, I don't know if you know that we produced the Robert John record.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Only we did not want to put our names on the record as producers. So one of the guys in the group, his name was Hank Medris, his name was put on the record as a producer, who was one of the Tokens. And the Tokens were the ones who sang the background on the Robert John record with this very famous songwriter called Ellie Greenwich. She was one of the singers on the Robert John record, which we produced about 10 years later.
And you did know, presumably, that Tight Fit had a number one in Britain in the 80s.
Yeah, I knew that. You know, it was a much different kind of version. It was, I guess, more of a dance kind of version, Tight Fit. I didn't realize that it was a number one record. I know it was a hit record in the UK, but I didn't realize it was number one.
I'm Paul Gambaccini. You're listening to The Lion Sleeps Tonight, part two of The Greatest Hits of the World from the BBC. The Lion Sleeps Tonight was a British number one in 1982 by Tight Fit. But to accurately track the success of the song, completists would have to include versions in other languages. For example, Henri Salvador in 1962 and Pow Wow in 1993 had number ones in France with Le Lion est mort ce soir. A new focus for interest in the song appeared in 1994. In the Disney film The Lion King, Meerkat Timon and Warthog Pumbaa casually sing a fragment of The Lion Sleeps Tonight. When the movie was turned into a Broadway musical, the song was also featured. On stage and screen, The Lion Sleeps Tonight has recently been enjoying its greatest global success. This has meant ever-increasing artist royalty checks for the Tokens, a pleasant surprise for Jay Siegel.
Somebody said, I just heard your song in the movie. Or that, I didn't know until the movie was out that they told me that the two characters were singing The Lion Sleeps Tonight in the movie. And that was like, I think that night I ran out to see the movie. I had no idea. No idea.
Now, of course, with the show still running around the world, a lot of people every day will get curious and will download your song.
Yeah, it's still being downloaded, and I know that it's played on, you know, and all these stage versions, you know, for the Lion King theatrical performance. And also, there's a big in Disney World in the United States, and two of the Disney Worlds, one of the attractions is called the Animal Kingdom, and they sing that song every day in that show as well. So that. It seems to be endless. The song just seems to be endless.
Mbube, Wimaway, The Lion Sleeps Tonight is truly one of the greatest hits of the world. But until recently, its originator and his heirs received very little of the vast fortune the song has generated. Rion Malana has played a part in redressing that.
I at one stage had a master list of covers and other usages that I'd laboriously put together, and I sent it to any number of people who work in music publishing, both in South Africa and England, and to some extent in America, and just ask them to make an estimate. They all said, well, of course, it's entirely impossible, but if I was to risk making a fool of myself, the sort of consensus figure was somewhere in the region of $16 million. That was in 2000, $16 million over the lifetime of the song. And Solomon Linda, let's see, add up what Solomon Linda got. From Gallo Record Company, he would have got nothing except his initial recording fee. He got $1,000 from Pete Seeger and a tiny trickle of royalties from the Wimaware version. And somewhere along the line, sometime in the 1970s, he started getting maybe 1% or 2% of the profits that were generated by the massively successful Lion Sleeps Tonight version. But unfortunately, this is never enough money at all to make any impact at all in his destiny. He died completely poverty-stricken.
Following the appearance of Malana's article in Rolling Stone, lawyers tackled the case. In 2004, Dr. Owen Dean seized on a clause of the Imperial Copyright Act of 1911, which decreed that rights to a song reverted to a composer's estate 25 years after his death. Since Solomon Linda had died in 1962, his family should have been receiving very substantial sums after 1987. This had not happened.
The Disney Corporation would never have heard of Solomon Linda or this copyright dispute, but it put them in a rather embarrassing situation. You know, this American firm that specializes in sort of family values, etc., was suddenly being accused of taking bread out of the mouths of poor African people. They didn't really like that at all. So I think they brought withering pressure to bear on the American copyright holders, and after 18 months of posturing and the beating of war drums, the case was settled out of court. I'm not at liberty to disclose the actual terms, but I mean, one of the conditions was that if you look at the most recent re-recordings of Lion Sleeps Tonight, you'll see that Solomon Linda's name has at last appeared on the song, and his family receives, nothing's perfect, but it's probably, you know, a reasonable share of the song's profits, certainly enough money to transform their destiny. And what we're left with is, I think, it's an extraordinary story about the music really isn't a universal language, the way in which stuff from a culture as remote as Zulu could affect left-wing New Yorkers and then the tokens and then the entire world. And I mean, for me as a South African, it makes me very proud.
The Greatest Hits of the World was produced by Kevin Howlett and was an independent production for the BBC by Howlett Media Productions. I'm Paul Gambaccini. Thanks for listening.
There are dozens of different podcasts now available from the BBC, including news, documentaries, science, business, arts and sport. For details of them all, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.